Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're very excited to welcome psychologist Dr. Frank Farley back to the show to talk about the three women that were rescued in Cleveland after being held captive for about a decade. Dr. Farley is going to talk about what needs to happen now to help these women acclimate to being free and back in society. Up next is social media expert Patrick Charles talking about the new Twitter music and if it's right for you. We then hear from an amazing blues rock band out of Vancouver, Head of the Herd, and then we wrap things up with a tribute to actress Jeannie Cooper of The Young and the Restless and a remix from Cat de Luna, Stars.
Capture your need for sound.
An incredible story of survival and perseverance has come out of Cleveland, Ohio. Three women who were abducted on separate occasions about a decade ago have been found and released after one of the women, Amanda Berry, was able to break free and get help. Joining us to talk about the aftermath of these events is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist, and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, thank you again for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
You're welcome.
So, Dr. Farley, let's start with the three women who have been freed after about a decade of captivity. What can they expect as they, you know, acclimate to quote-unquote a normal life?
Well, it isn't going to be easy, and it may never, you know, be totally successful. That is what has been found with some other cases. There are hardly any cases to equal this one on record, but, you know, Elizabeth Smart and others who have gone through something similar have weighed in on it, and it does look as if it's possible they might never, you know, return to normal, if you will. They're going to, you know, there's going to be all sorts of psychological things that could happen as time goes on. You know, anger might be one, depression. They may get irritable. They may develop some PTSD symptoms. Reliving it, you know, emotionally, flashbacks, anxiety. They may feel sort of numb, have trouble concentrating. They may develop fear for their safety. I mean, they certainly don't want this to happen again, of course. Mm-hmm. And there could be sleep problems. So, you know, one of the things that worries me is there's a trial coming up.
Right.
And they will probably be subpoenaed to testify. And so, you know, they may end up reliving a lot of this trauma. And that's always a problem. But, you know, there are certain recommendations I think can be made based upon other experiences. One of the ones that a lot of people who have gone through anything remotely like this say is, it's very helpful to avoid too much media involvement in the immediate, you know, aftermath, because what's going to happen in the, with the media is they're going to be asking you how you feel, what was it like, et cetera, and you end up reliving this whole horror over and over again. So just about everybody seems to recommend trying to stay clear of that for at least a period of time. They may want to see a therapist, you know, again, the trial. And I don't think they can avoid the trial. So they may want to have a therapist to be working with somebody to prepare them for that event. Family is very important. They've been away for 10 years from any family. So family is very important, reconnecting friends and peers, reconnecting there if at all possible. Community issues. Again, one of the problems there too is reliving, recounting the whole thing over and over again. So one would hope that their friends and their peers and their family won't, you know, badger them to relate this horror story over and over. And faith for some can be helpful. Their faith, their religion can be helpful. Elizabeth Smart has made some recommendations. One thing that she said was, just try to live one day at a time. So, you know, until this thing is behind you, the trial is gone, and so on, you know, don't worry about big time plans. Just live one day at a time, one step at a time. And as she said, you still have a life to lead. And there is still hope. They're young. And, you know, they have a whole life laying out in front of them. And so she wanted to strongly emphasize that there's hope. They got a life. And things will get better.
I wanted to speak to you about the location, Cleveland, now, or West Cleveland, if you want to get specific. It sounds like, obviously, they weren't too far off from their neighborhood as to where they grew up and so on. Now that they are free, and I just actually finished reading an article just a few moments before you and I started talking, and it sounds like Amanda Berry has been taken to her sister's house, which they did say is several miles away from where she was held. But obviously, to me, again, it still seems like it's in the same area. Are they going to need to get out of there? Are they going to need to move? Or can they make a life for themselves in Cleveland?
Well, personally, I would recommend that they get out of there. It's just too, it's psychologically close. And, you know, they may have fears, anxieties, that this could happen again. And, you know, I think it's going to be a lot better to get shuck of Cleveland, frankly, and if they can do it, and move somewhere else. You know, it's like a second chance,
okay,
a second start. And often that's refreshing, invigorating, you know, putting behind one a past and moving on to a whole new thing. And, you know, life has got second chances. And I think that it would be aided if they weren't in the same community. No matter what, if they're living there, they're going to be reminded, and people are going to see them, and they're going to want to talk with them, etc. And they may be better served, maybe only for a period of time, but to just get away.
Now, it's been reported that the child that was found with the three women is actually Amanda's daughter, a 6-year-old daughter, I believe, Jocelyn, I think. And, you know, so I wanted to ask you about that. What challenges is this child going to face along with Amanda, you know, coming back into society, especially because the child is basically a product of Amanda's captor and sexual abuse?
That's right. It's a child of rape, mm-hmm, essentially. And, well, she will have some troubles, reentry problems, you know. Again, I think that's why it's better to be away. You know, when she gets into school, kids are going to know about it. There's just no way around that. Kids in the community. And it's going to be brought up to her over and over again. So, boy, I hope that Amanda can find a way to move on somewhere else and basically, you know, create a new life for her and her daughter. That would be the best. Short of that, you know, they're going to just have to, you know, make it clear to people to please leave the daughter out of it. Let her, you know, kids are very resilient. And she's probably very close to Amanda. I mean, they've probably been, you know, totally connected, the two of them, mm-hmm, and in the face of this horror. And so that's going to be a very positive thing. And kids, you know, often recover fairly well and can be very resilient. But I think the environment is, staying around that neighborhood is not conducive to it. There's too many likelihoods of the daughter being identified and constantly reminded of what happened. The daughter of rape, for God's sakes. And under these horrible circumstances, and there's going to be this trial, and it's going to be a sensational trial, no question about that. So she needs, if at all possible, a fresh world and a fresh life.
Joining us on the show is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, let's talk about the criminals, the Castro brothers, which seem to apparently, at least at the time being, it's being portrayed that 52-year-old Ariel Castro was, I guess, the ringleader, if you will. But have you ever heard of three family members, three brothers coming together to, you know, to do this, to hold people capture, women capture like this for so long?
Never. Never. And if they are indeed, you know, I mean, if all of these things are proven to be true, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. But it certainly is looking bad. And I have never seen a case like this. You know, one of the things that struck me about it was the incredible planning that had to be involved in this. And they had to be vigilant for years. It seems almost to beyond belief that 10 years in a small house, that's a very small house, 1,400 square feet, and that the 10 years in there that they were not able to escape and they were not seen. There was one or two strange sightings, and nothing came of those, unfortunately. But it bespeaks how these three guys apparently were really careful and controlling. Mm-hmm. It really does boggle the mind that one of them didn't say something to somebody. Look, Ariel's son himself didn't know anything about it.
Wow.
Allegedly. You know, his son, I think, is now a college student, if I'm not mistaken, and he didn't know anything about what was going on there. So how do you pull that off unless you are super controlling, super careful, and that you're working together? You know, you're not going out and getting drunk at one of you getting drunk somewhere and telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
So it bespeaks, you know, a really finely honed horror that was able to survive for 10 years.
Dr. Farley, what would their motivation be, and what or if can you categorize them as a type of criminal? Like, are they a psychopath? Are they sociopaths? What are these people?
Well, we don't know, of course. So, you know, anything would be speculation. But they certainly seem to have lacked empathy, let's put it that way. And, you know, that's one of the qualities often seen in psychopaths. Another quality sometimes seen in psychopaths is sort of stimulation seeking. My guess is they had some of that. Who do they have in that house? They had three women, and they allegedly were tying them up. There was chains and so on, and presumably there was a huge amount of sexuality involved. And there may be other children. There's been some allegations about that. So it seemed to be a sexual horror, and, you know, all-around criminal horror. And so, you know, they might come out as psychopaths. You know, my guess is they will end up being tested and studied closely, and they should. If there's one thing that comes out of this other than the wonderful freedom of the three women, it is we got to study this whole thing from beginning to end. We got to study these three perpetrators. And this is a kind of window into the heart of darkness, and we don't get many chances to do that. So I think it's so important. Elizabeth Smart herself has sort of dedicated her life to the whole concept of prevention, and she's absolutely right. You know, we've got to learn from this, every little bit of detail and so on, and try to put together a picture. What were the motives? Is there a profile of their behavior that we would recognize in the future? How did they accomplish it, and how did they keep the lid on all those years? That's astounding, in a neighborhood where they're living what looked like 20 feet away from another house. That's really scary to think that there's a house of horrors right next to you and you have no idea, and it's been there 10 years.
How do you think the ladies, the three of them, you know, Gina, Amanda, and Michelle, how are they able to survive such a long time in captivity mentally? Like, on some level, did they have to compartmentalize what was going on? I guess, hopefully, they were able to lean on each other for support, and, you know, if one's down, the other one could sort of pick them up and keep going.
I would think so. I would think that sharing and, you know, being in this thing together was key. My guess is that these three guys may have well threatened them that if they escaped, they would do something to their loved ones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's often a scenario. You know, if you try to escape, we're going to kill your parents.
Right.
And so who knows? Maybe that happened too. But, boy, trying to keep your sanity under those conditions, I think, would be so important to be talking about it, to be sharing. And, yes, compartmentalizing, of course. There had to be a lot of that, you know, just keep your sanity.
Are they bonded for life, Dr. Farley? Like, do you think on some level, is it going to be helpful or hurtful for them to be, you know, to see each other and to talk to each other? Like, should they still be in contact?
I don't know, because there are so few cases for us to base that on. But, you know, if I were to speculate, I would say that probably in the long run, it is good to stay in touch.
Right.
That's my guess.
Okay.
Because they must be pretty close to each other.
Right.
I can't see how they could not be in the face of this. And so...
And each of them would understand how they... Like, no one else is going to understand except for those three.
Bingo.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And before I let you go, we talked briefly about family and friends and the key role that they need to play. What would you say is the, you know, the top things that they need to do in the days and months to come, or days and weeks even? I don't even want to talk about months, but what should the family and friends of each of these three ladies be focusing on in the days and weeks to come?
Well, love, the wonderful four-letter word, that's number one. Unconditional love, unconditional acceptance, and so on. You know, that if they've been repeatedly raped and all this kind of stuff, you know, don't get into that. You know, that's the horror. Put the horror out of the discussion, out of the picture, and just show unconditional love, unconditional acceptance. I would also be urging that maybe, you know, try to get into some activities, some things that are different from the life they've led for 10 years, you know, some travel, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
Some fun activities, some uplifting activities. Try to encourage people who come into contact with them to not get into it, you know, not
right.
get into the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can begin to sort of psychologically rebuild. And I think the family would be a key ingredient.
Dr. Farley, thank you so much, as always, for your time today.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Since the invention of music downloads in the late 90s, the music industry has been in a constant state of change. Consumers have never had more choice of ways to listen to media than ever before. With the rise of smartphones in the last few years, those choices have multiplied in a way that's almost impossible to keep up with. What is next? Well, we have some of the answers for you, that's for sure. Joining us for his first time on The Kelly Alexander Show and the newest member of The Kelly Alexander Show team in the social media department is one Mr. Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks. How are you?
Fantastic. And we're really happy to have you as part of the team. And we can't wait to talk about all good things. And I know that this week we're going to feature or focus on Twitter music, which has been the buzz in the last couple of weeks. So if people don't know yet what that is, what exactly is Twitter music?
Well, it's really interesting. It's an app that you can basically follow what people are listening to online through Twitter. Now, what that means is, I mean, Twitter has like 200 million active users, right, at any given moment. And those users are always tweeting what they're listening to. So Twitter figured, what a great way to tap into the zeitgeist, because I love that word, of what people like to listen to and use this as sort of a metrics for the consumers and for the industry to know what to put out. Because, I mean, everybody has like chart shows that they listen to, but every radio station, if you listen to them, they'll all be different because they focus on their specific style of music. So what Twitter music does is it follows what people are listening to globally, and it gives you a way to keep track of it and also to find some new stuff, which is really great about it.
Now, does this work for people all over the planet, or is this, you know, mainly American-based right now? Can we here in Canada have access to this?
Yes, absolutely. Because the thing is, it's linked into two different services right now. Now, there's a lot of talk about subscription music services. The biggest one you've probably heard of is Spotify in the U.S. We don't have that one in Canada, but they have it in Europe. They have it in the U.S. It's massive. It's the leader. Basically, what you do is you pay a fee per month, and you're able to listen to as much music as you want. You're not actually downloading it. You're just streaming it through your phone, through your computer, wherever you are. So that's the cool thing about it. So Twitter Music links into that, and when you actually see a track that you want to listen to, you listen to it through the service. Now in Canada, like I mentioned, we don't have Spotify, but we do have something called RDIO, which is radio without the A, say R-D-I-O, and that service is the same thing for us Canadians. It's also in the U.S. and Europe, and you can play your tracks through that. So through your smartphone, you can listen to full tracks. Otherwise, you're just listening to iTunes previews.
Gotcha. Now, is this Twitter Music actually good for the industry?
Well, I think it is, and I think that the industry is behind it to a degree because, first of all, it gives them a chance to see what people are talking about the most, regardless of what gets released. I mean, something might be released, like, you know, like a massive Justin Timberlake album, let's say, but it won't necessarily be the thing that people are talking the most about online, and that gives the industry a lot of insight into what people are really into and what they really care about.
How is it good for us little guys, the consumers?
Well, one thing about Twitter and one thing about social media is the fact that people love to feel like they're contributing in some way to the success of people that they love. So if you can tweet about an artist that you love and that maybe isn't that big, you're somehow contributing to their sort of global presence by putting their name out there as often as possible. And of course, every time you play one of the songs through a streaming service, they get paid. So that's very important as well.
Now, if you are an indie band or a band that's, or an artist that's just sort of starting to get going and or trying to get going, is this a way where you can maybe cause a bit of a groundswell?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you never know. There's so many bands don't have albums released, but they just have a single released and they put it out on a blog, let's say, on their website. And next thing you know, people are talking about it. And, you know, it sort of works in reverse now where it's like you'll have a lot of a big campaign happening online before you get a record deal. And you'd be amazed at how many groups aren't signed to anyone, but you're hearing about them all the time. So that's happening quite a bit these days.
And how is streaming different, or is it even better than iTunes? Because I have heard people say that they get a bit tired of iTunes.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I mean, you got to think about it. A lot of people can't get out of the mindset of ownership of stuff, and that was the idea. Like, when you got away from CDs, you used to go out, buy your CDs, you had them in your house, and you could play them whenever you wanted. And then when iTunes came out, people were like, well, I don't get the box, I don't get the album art, that sort of thing. It seems like that's kind of going away because people are using a lot of sort of interactive websites, and there's always, every band has like a Facebook account, and they have a website, and there's so much content to look at. So the difference is now with streaming is that you're paying per month, usually it's $10 a month for the full package, right? But you can listen to whatever you want. You don't actually physically own anything or physically download anything. You just stream it whenever you feel like hearing it. So rather than loading up your phone before you go on a road trip, you're basically just playing it from their computers every time you want to hear it.
Is it possible on this service, Twitter Music, to be hearing like remixes and B-sides and all that kind of stuff too?
Yeah, absolutely. It depends on what the band wants to make available because the band can put anything on their Twitter page and that's what will play for you through Twitter Music.
And how do you go about getting Twitter Music? Do you just type that in Google and then go from there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a website that's really quite good. The Twitter Music website is quite good. And the iPhone app is amazing. They're working on an Android app, so that would probably be out by the end of the year. But right now, probably the best way to listen is through your phone because your phone is always on you.
This is true. And do you think Twitter Music is going to replace some of the other things that are out there now that people have been listening to? Like, is this going to make obsolete other apps or other services that have been out there before?
Well, what's interesting about it is it's actually built on the back of another service that they bought. It was called We Are Hunted. It was around for a few years, based out of Australia, and Twitter actually bought it to revamp as Twitter Music. So I think that a lot of things will be sort of crushed by it in the future, but it'll take a while.
I wanted to throw this at you, and I know this is coming out of left field, but the revamped MySpace, is that something that people can be excited about? I don't even know if it's out yet, but I know that Justin Timberlake was involved.
It is out, and I have tried it, and I don't see it becoming a thing. I just don't see it getting that sort of coolness back that it used to have. And I'm not sure if people who didn't know about it the first time actually care about it this time because everybody's so busy with Facebook and Twitter.
Okay. And do you think it was a mistake for him to be involved with it, or do you think it's not really going to reflect? Because obviously everyone is so excited that he's back out with new music and touring with Jay-Z this summer and then touring on his own later on in the fall. Do you think his association with this was a bad decision on his part?
I don't think it was a bad decision, because I don't think people really hold that kind of stuff against celebrities. But I'll tell you this, though. I mean, he just announced the second part of his album, right? The 2.0 version of his album is coming out in November, I believe. And he announced it on Instagram.
Oh, nice.
So it doesn't say too much for his belief in MySpace at this point.
That's true. Do you think that like MySpace is just going to sort of tumble away? Because it seems like they put so much effort into trying to relaunch this thing.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to let it sit, because if they try to put it in people's faces too much, it's going to look more like a failure. So I think if they just let it sit, and who knows, maybe, you know, maybe a year from now, this is all going to be, you know, MySpace will be the number one social network again. But at this point, I think they have to leave it alone a bit, so at least it can pick up steam on its own.
And one last thing I wanted to ask you about, you and I had sort of talked about this last week, but I all of a sudden, since you and I talked about it, all of a sudden I'm seeing it on my Facebook feed. They're promoting the Swell app. Can you tell us what that is?
Oh, the Swell app is an amazing way to listen to podcasts. What it is basically, there are a lot of apps like Stitcher is fantastic, but what Swell does is it kind of gives you what you're in the mood for. You have a page where you can just sort of choose a topic, entertainment, sports, news, anything. And when you hit that, it gives you three things in that style. Now, what it does is a lot of things use these sort of these algorithms to figure out what people are enjoying. So as you go through it, the more you listen to specific stuff, the more it offers you things in that vein.
Okay. And is this has it been around for a while? And do you think that it will also replace some other things or become really prolific?
No, I don't think it's going to replace anything, because I think that there's room for all of this stuff, and people have sort of different needs with the way they listen to things and the way they look for stuff. So I think it'll probably get quite big, but I don't think it'll actually replace anything.
And what is your favorite app right now? Just, you know, when it comes to listening to stuff, would it be the Twitter Music?
Actually, right now, I'm pretty hooked on Twitter Music, to be honest.
Okay.
Because it's very interactive. That's the cool thing about it, because you can let it play, and then all of a sudden you'll hear something you haven't heard before, because there's a popular chart, which will give you stuff that's pretty familiar. There's an emerging chart, which will give you stuff that, you know, you've never heard before a lot of the time, which is fantastic. And it also does suggestions, which is great.
Cool. So if people want to get in touch with you, Patrick, like on Twitter or on Facebook, how can they do that?
I'm Patrick Henry Charles on Facebook, and you can get me at GetPatrick on Twitter.
Fantastic. Patrick, can't wait to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. It was a blast.
That's Patrick Charles again, the latest and newest member of the Kelly Alexander Show team. We can't wait to have him back on the show. For all information as well, go to our website, kellyalexandershow.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is lead singer of Vancouver's Head of the Herd, New Manis. New, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kelly, how you doing?
Very well, and we're really excited to have you on the show. And I wanted to you know, talk about your band. How did you guys actually come together? And how would you, I guess, explain your sound?
Well, basically, the band got started on a trip to Boise, Idaho, to go watch a Broncos game. And through a weekend of some boot mickeys and some good times, we decided we'd start writing songs together. So the sound is basically modern blues, we like to call it. So we're sort of taking the storytelling traditions of our bluesy forefathers and then kicking it in the face with some rock and roll.
Gotcha. That sounds very like power blues almost in a way.
Yeah, like it's exciting, groovy music with a lot of blues influence to it.
Now, can you tell us where the band's name came from? Because that's quite the title to carry, Head of the Herd.
Yeah, it's a bit confident. But basically, Clay came up with the name actually, and he's the guitar player, and he was talking to one of his friends about thinking about what we should call the band once we had a couple songs, and they were running through some things, and his friend was just like, nah, man, you got to get Head of the Herd. And Clay's like, well, that's it right there. And he just stuck with that.
That's fantastic. And it's really original and something that obviously will stick out for people. And, you know, how would you, I guess, say that you can set yourself apart from the other bands that are out there now? Like, how do you guys feel that you're different from what's going on with some of the mainstream bands that people, you know about in Canada?
I feel like, honestly, we got grooves. And it's I think at rock and roll, a lot of people have lost the roll to it, and it's just a bit too steady Eddie, whereas we really try to make really rhythmic music, but also very like passionate music when it comes to the words. And we're bringing storytelling back to songwriting is really what our goal is there.
How would you explain your writing process? Do you guys work on it together? Does one of you start, the other one finish? Like, is there a process, or is it sort of natural and organic?
Honestly, yeah, I'd say it's more organic because there's never really been a set way that we just decide to do things. Like, sometimes I'll show up with a full song, sometimes Clay will come in with a riff, and we'll just work it from there. And it's everyone's been different, and that's what keeps it fun.
Can you talk to us about your new album, which comes out on June 4th, By This Time Tomorrow? Does the, you know, album have like an overall theme, and what do you want your fans and new fans to take away from it?
Well, we just want people to sort of get involved and really feel the words, because it's like, we're all about the storytelling. So if you come out of that and you're still got those hooks rattling around in your head, but you're still feeling that there was a real story behind it, that to us is sort of mission accomplished there.
What have you learned about Canada, having crossed the country touring? And do you hope that some of those experiences that you've had in your home country, you'll maybe pick up if you know, go to the States or go to Europe or Australia or Asia?
Well, I'd say, like, we got a country of some really wonderful people who are just so passionate about music. And you'll go to gigs and some people know who you are and some don't, but it's always a receptive, friendly crowd, and everyone doesn't mind getting loose too. So it's a really fun country to play in.
What do you feel like when you're actually up on stage in towns maybe that you haven't been to before? Do you feel like a challenge to win the crowd over, or is it just you go up there, you do your thing as head of the herd?
You know, like, it's obviously, it's a challenge, but I'd say in this band anyway, like, a room full of strangers is the best, because you're winning people over. So we're working harder. And I think that comes across, and that's sort of what builds the energy in the room.
How would you explain your live show? Because, like you just said earlier, you're a band that moves, like, meaning you've got a groove going on and stuff. Do you, you know, obviously try to push that when you're on stage as well, that people really feel like your rhythm section and what's going on?
Yeah, I'd say, like, honestly, we're a band based off rhythm. So we got the bass and drums is what's sort of leading the charge there. And so we get room shaking pretty good.
Who would you look up to as other bands that have come before you? Like, is there a band right now that you would say has really inspired you? And is there a band or an artist that you would love to collaborate with in the future?
Honestly, Clay and I, we cannot shut up about the Rolling Stones. That is a big influence on us and one of our favorite bands. So if we could get on stage with those boys, we'd be pretty happy.
Fantastic. And can you tell us how important in your mind social media is for Head of the Herd in getting the word out about you guys?
I'd say it's crucial. To be honest, like, it's a brand new thing, but the fact that we can speak directly to our fans and they can find us and interact with us in that way is something that's never existed before, and I feel like it's been quite special to us, and it's important to us to interact with people over that.
Do you have a favorite social media? Like, are you a Facebook person, a Twitter guy, Instagram? Like, how does that work?
Honestly, I quite enjoy Facebook. Because it's broad, so you can share music there, you can share video there, you can be brief, or you can be a bit long-winded, so that's where I like to speak to people.
You know, I have to tell you, I really appreciate that you said Facebook, because, and I think that sort of ties into maybe how you are a storyteller, because most of the bands and artists that I interview always tell me that it's Twitter, because they want to get in, they want to get out, so I think it's really interesting that you have chosen a form where you could go longer, if you will.
Yeah, well, just there's some things you cannot say in 140 characters, and so I really enjoy being able to occasionally just write a paragraph because I have more to say.
Is there a song in your new album that really speaks to you? And I know that's hard to sort of say, because I'm sure they're all sort of your babies, if you will. But is there a song that particularly sticks out for you? Or is there a song that you perform that really gets you going?
You know, there's one, and it's the fifth song on the record. It's called We Could Get Together. And so it's one that was produced by Garth Richardson, and he's a dude who did the first Rage album, and he's a legend, and he's a big part of this record. And that was one that we sort of came in, and the demo, no one really knew what was going to come from it, and he just put us in a room, had us bang it away on the drums, and then all of a sudden that song was night and day different, and it's one that right off the bat just slaps you in the face and hits rhythmically like nothing I've heard in a long time.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is lead singer of Head of the Herd, New Menace. New, can you let us know, like, do you ever think that the band might relocate to the States, like New York or Los Angeles, or do you think you'll always stay based out of Canada?
You know, I got a lot of love for Canada, so I got no plans to jump ship at this point.
And how would you categorize the Canadian music scene right now? Because I have listeners right now that are obviously listening across Canada as well as across the States. And we actually have people listening in Australia and Asia. So if you were talking to, you know, my listeners in Australia and Asia, what would you say is Canada on the music scene these days?
I'd say we have a lot of creative people writing a lot of great music. And it's a tough country to break just because the population is so small. But it's sort of a similar thing to Australia, right? A lot of land, not a whole lot of people. So it's, but even there too, like you got a lot of great people writing great songs, and that's what needs to be happening to stem anything, you know.
Before I let you go, what can we expect from you guys in the next, you know, year or 18 months? Obviously, the new album's coming out, but are there other plans as well that's coming along with that?
Yeah, obviously, like with the record will come a tour and some videos and a lot of content online. So I'd say just make sure you keep up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Fantastic. New, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's New Manus again from Head of the Herd. And for more information where you can grab all of their social media, go to their website, headoftheherdmusic.com.
This is New from Head of the Herd, and you're listening to The Kelly Alexander Show.
By this time tomorrow, I won't love you like today. By this time tomorrow, I'll feel the break of day. By this time tomorrow, I'll have pissed away my pain. By this time tomorrow, I'll be lonely yet again. Don't you leave me like you did before. I know I hurt you when I said I needed more.
I'm not sure if I've ever talked to you about this before, but I have a very deep and profound love for soap operas, in particular, The Young and the Restless. I've been a fan for more years than I care to count. And luckily for me and all other YNR fans, it's a solid show. It's been the number one daytime drama for years. And that basically means there's lots of good acting and lots of great storylines. Now, sadly, for all of us in the YNR family, if you will, there's been a sad time in the last couple of days. The lead actress, or the matriarch of the show, Jeannie Cooper, who was 84 years old and portrayed Catherine Chancellor for about four decades now. I think she was on the show 39 years or was heading into her 40th. She actually just passed away in real life. And so many of us who are YNR fans are just devastated because she, you know, is pretty much the face and the heart and the soul of Young and the Restless. And I know I'm sort of grappling with the fact of, you know, not knowing how it's going to feel when she's actually off the show, because right now they're about 6 weeks in advance of real life. So right now, Jeannie Cooper, Catherine Chancellor, is actually still on the canvas of The Young and the Restless, but it won't be very long before they're going to have to figure out a way to write her out. Now, maybe you're questioning why I would be talking so fondly about soap operas and in particular Young and the Restless, but really, it's such a great show, and if you are a fan of soap operas, you really sort of, it's with you for life. And a lot of people poo-poo soap operas and say that, you know, it's not a real acting medium, and it's not, you know, movies, it's not, you know, nighttime television. But honestly, I have so much respect for soap actors. They have to get through so many pages of dialogue, and unlike movies, they don't get 15 chances to get it right. They get one or two chances to get it right, and that's it. And Jeannie Cooper is a marvel. She is amazing. The storylines that she has been through in all the years that I've watched has just been a joy to watch, and she really connects with you, and I'm really, really, really going to miss her. And by all accounts, sort of checking out online how other people are feeling, there's a lot of people that feel the same way I do. So I just wanted to take a moment and pay homage to her, and I've actually put together a little montage of Jeannie so you get to know her in case you haven't had the pleasure of watching her. So you're going to get to hear her talk a little bit about advice that she would give to daytime actors. She's going to talk about working with her son, Corbin Burnson, who is also an actor and who used to be on L.A. Law and a bunch of other shows. She also talks about what it was like to finally win the Daytime Emmy Award in 2008 after many years of being nominated. And then we finish off, actually, I want you to hear her acceptance speech from that Emmy Awards back in 2008. So on behalf of all the, you know, the Young and the Restless fans that are out there, just wanted to take a moment to pay homage to an amazing actress. And from all accounts, even though I never met her in person, she sounds like a lovely lady and was an inspiration to many. So Jeannie Cooper, we are going to miss you. We love you. And thank you so much for everything that you've done on The Young and the Restless since it started back in 1973. So without further ado, here is Jeannie Cooper in her own words.
Well, there is so little advice that one can give. I think the major advice that I have to give, starting out on daytime, you have to focus. You have to be prepared. Daytime is a great learning process, not for other things, but for daytime itself. Daytime is an art. And anyone who thinks it isn't, don't try it. You'll be a star for a day, and deservedly so. It is a media that takes time, and most of all, it takes focus. You have to want to do this, portray a life, day in and day out. Make it exciting. As your life has been dull on days, you can't be that way in daytime. You're not going to be a winner every day, but you better make sure your character is. Now, that takes more than just studying. That takes your training. That takes discipline. That takes a work ethic. You better be prepared. Offer the most that you can give, that you know of. If you're fortunate, you get a good director who will bring more out of you, but make sure that you have it to give and you're willing to give it. If you're willing to do that, you probably will be working in the most difficult media that's on the boards today. That includes motion pictures, that includes primetime TV. Nothing. And I've done them all. Nothing is more difficult than this media and making it work, whether you're a technician or whether you're an actor. It's called you better be ready to move learn, develop, and perform. It doesn't need anything less. And the ones who prosper in this media are the ones who have done exactly that. Catherine Chancellor originally was this raving alcoholic, drunk, and her whole life is upside down, and she's married this Philip Chancellor. She was to perpetuate a love story between Philip Chancellor and Jill Foster, who Jill Foster was on the wrong side of the tracks. And Philip Chancellor, of course, was appointed and inherited. My husband, my first husband, Catherine Chancellor's first husband, died while they were having sex in Europe somewhere. And so she turned into this raving alcoholic, and Philip Chancellor was her husband's manager of all of the textiles and industries that they had. So, and this is all backstory, mind you. And he came to her aid, and she was very sad about Gary's death, and through consoling her, marries her. And she just drinks to the point that, you know, life is not done well by her. Very rich, very bored. And then she becomes sober, but that's after he dies. I mean, we both were in the car crash. I could have died. Well, tough. He died. Good for him. Bully for me. And that's when Catherine's son, played by Bo Kaser, came into being. I didn't know I had a son, but I had a son. And when I opened the door and he's singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic with his guitar, I think I was ready to go back to motion pictures. The son comes in, and he's now Jesus is his master, and he wants his mother to sober up, because her life is going awry, and Philip, you know, he's not with Jill. That's his new young love. So Catherine does sober up, and so this was the advancement. I have to tell you, even to this day, I will go out for different kinds of bookings and what have you, and someone will clasp my hands and say, thank you so much for everything, and their chip will be in my hand. And I called AA about it, and I said, you know, what should I do? They said, if that's the way they stay sober, take their chip. So it was amazing. So Catherine has become the matriarch of the show, and I have now going 4 generations. Lovely thing through the acting business. My son and I have spent some time together on screen. My son, Corbin Burnson, actor, always has a mother in almost everything he does. And he's a very superstitious kind of guy. And he said to them at L.A. Law, could my mom play my mom? And so they called up my availability and, was okay with the Y&R people. And so I played his mom. And in the first episodes of... He and I both got an Emmy nomination together, and that was sort of exciting to get a nomination together as mother and son. And he deserved it. I deserved the nomination also. I really did. I was very proud of what I did. And therefore, in every part he's ever played, when we've done, Touched by an Angel, as another one, and the bin things, whatever those were, and a couple of, I think they were independent movies of the week for television, where he had mothers. I would always play his mother. He was very superstitious about that I play his mother. And of course, I have such fun opposite him because he is a fine actor. I can honestly say, were he just a stranger. He's a very fine actor, very fine. And he's also known to writing and directing, which is a talent I've known he's always had. He's just extending himself at this point. Exciting.
You recently won the Daytime Emmy Award.
Oh.
Talk about that. Finally.
Finally, after how many nominations?
Well deserved.
Oh, hey, listen, I began to feel like Meryl Streep there for a while. The name was always there, Meryl, get on stage. Yes, that was very exciting moment. And, of course, I'd won the Lifetime Achievement Award, and that was exciting. The AFTRA Foundation Award, the Amy, that's exciting. But to be put there by your peers is a gesture and an honor, and put you into a category that there's so many incredibly good actors and actresses out there that never are put in the position of nomination for any of their peers to say yay or nay. So I have to honor that as an honor in itself, to be put there and in nomination as many times, and there has been many times, to finally win an Emmy is exciting.
And the Emmy goes to Jean Cooper as Catherine Chandler, the Young and the Restless.
This is the first daytime Emmy for Jeannie Cooper. She's currently the longest tenured actor on The Young and the Restless.
I bet you thought I had died. Oh, dear, high definition or not high definition, what can I tell you? It's a bitch, isn't it? I have so many people to thank that I won't. Because everybody has the best directors and writers and what have you, so I would like to thank our lousy directors and writers, our lousy Sony, our lousy CBS, a lousy staff, wardrobe, all departments. We are the lousiest. But we're still number one, guys. Thank you so much. Corbin, Colin, my real family. You surprised me, Corbin. Thank you very much. I love you all. What a great profession. God bless.
Bring on the remix.
Oh,
That's Kat DeLuna with Stars, the Riddler radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, Dr. Frank Farley, Patrick Charles, as well as the band Head of the Herd. Here's your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Benjamin Franklin. Do not anticipate trouble or worry about what may never happen. Keep in the sunlight. Please be active with us on our social media. You can follow us on Twitter at @KAlexanderShow. Also, check out our YouTube channel for lots of interviews, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. And as always, on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.